This is Peter with Let the Bird Fly. We're back today with another Bird's Eye View episode. On this episode, you will hear Mike discuss Christian vocation to an audience in West Dallas, Wisconsin. This is the second part of a lecture given by Wade and Mike at the first of Nain Evangelical Lutheran Church's new lecture series. Wade's lecture was posted previously, so if you haven't listened to that yet, you can find it at letthebirdfly.com under our Bird's Eye View category. We will also be releasing the question and answer session that Wade and Mike held after the talk soon, so stay tuned for that as well. Enough from me, though. Let's get on to Mike's talk. Enjoy.
All right. Thank you for having me. The microphone is now on, I guess. The handout that you have is just a collection of quotes on vocation, some from Scripture, some not. Probably could have added quite a few more, but I wanted to stop. So we're not going to use those. I'll reference a couple of them, but they're more for you to kind of look at right now and take home and just kind of look at when you get home, stick them in your Bible or something like that. When you're thinking about vocation, you can take a look at those. So with that, we'll begin. Our God is a gritty God. He is shockingly earthy. He gets in the mud and the blood and the beer. And the reason for that is that's because we're sinners are. And he has to come here because we can't go there. And so he must come all the way to us. And it begins in the incarnation when God becomes man. But it also makes sense if God is evangelical, that is, he's gospel-y, he wants all men to be saved, that he would not only come to save us, but it would also make sense that he would continue to come to love us. That he is not a deistic God who spins the earth into its orbit at creation and says, see you later, maybe I'll check in once in a while. But rather he is a God who is very intimately involved not only in the salvation of souls, but he's intimately involved into the day-to-day life of his creatures. Why? Because of love. Because of love. Because that is who he is. And so we must start with justification, as we had a whole lecture on justification and how that leads to freedom. We'll repeat some of that stuff because it's so very important. Think of Martin Luther in the monastery. His whole existence is there to please God. He's still thinking about justification, but it is a self-justification. And you can think about the word justification in the theological sense, just as we use it in regular day life. If I'm trying to justify my actions to you, I'm trying to make myself look just, right, righteous, maybe even valuable to you. And I would suggest that every action and every word that comes from our mouth and from our hands is an attempt to justify ourselves, our value before other people. It's just a part of who we are. And so it is why you make sure that your spouse knew that you did the dishes and you did it the right way. It is why eighth grade boys pretend like they don't care and don't try at school when they really do care, but trying means that they might fail and they might be embarrassed and it's easier not to care. It is the reason why eighth grade girls inexplicably still want the attention of those eighth grade boys. It is why we gossip, because if I have a little bit of information, then I have currency, and then I'm valuable to the rest of the group. Everything we do is an attempt to justify ourselves before each other, and ultimately, whether we admit it or not, to a higher being, to God. And so think of Luther in the monastery. Everything, all of his time and energy, really, is geared towards making God happy so that he can be seen as valuable to God. So the ultimate goal is that he has a clear conscience before God, of course, but really he's trying to make God happy. He really is. And that all changes when he discovers the gospel. Oh, and First, the law. Because the law says you can't make God happy. You can't. You literally cannot. Not by your own efforts. But then the gospel is, you don't have to. Because Jesus made God happy in your place. And so we have the righteousness of Christ that is given to us. And so I am just and I am righteous before God. I can't be, and yet I am because of Jesus Christ. Now, Luther in the monastery had all of his time and energy geared towards making God happy. Now that he doesn't have to do that, and he couldn't do it anyway, what's a monk to do with all of this time and energy? Well, we're too hard on the monastic system sometimes. They did a lot of good things. But theologically, they were wrong in that idea that there was an ethical orientation that was vertical, that was first. And so once you understand that that vertical ethical orientation cannot be, and we don't even have to try to be ethical towards God anymore, there is an ethical reorientation to a horizontal one, away, out to neighbor. And so for Luther's freedom, I'm freedom from the terror of trying to please God meant the freedom to try to please neighbor, or to love neighbor and to serve neighbor. An ethical reorientation occurs. You can think about it this way now. Well, let me take a step back and talk about worship for a second. I think the word worship probably is one of the worst words that we can describe Sunday morning. Because it seems to have this ethical orientation that's only vertical. I worship God, and he demands me to worship him. I suppose those are true statements. But it's not as if God is this narcissist who needs all of his minions to tell him how great he is all the time, right? The words in the Old Testament and the New Testament talk about worship. They're more talking about coming in the presence of God with holy awe and kneeling and maybe even bowing down and putting your nose in the dirt kind of thing. It's something just a little bit different. But then St. Paul says in Romans chapter 12 that our worship actually is out in the world. He says that you're free now to go out into the world and to live. And that is your worship. That is your worship. And so I think you need to think about Sunday morning as a time when you get, and Monday through Saturday as a time when you worship God in your everyday lives. And you can think about the love of God like a waterfall. So I come on Sunday mornings, and literally heaven and earth come together and smash together in the divine service where the divine word of God is spoken. And the pastor says, I forgive you all of your sins. Notice that he does not say God forgives you. He says, I forgive you, because there's no degree of difference between the troubled sinner and God's forgiveness. He says, I forgive you. As a pastor says it, it's as if Christ said it. And not only that, but then Christ's body and blood is going to come down, and it's going to soothe troubled souls with the forgiveness of sins. You go there in holy awe, and you get the love of God. Like a waterfall from heaven comes rushing down. Now, I suppose we could spend all of our time trying to figure out how to worship God and how to thank him rightly. And do we take buckets and take this water and try to throw it back up to him? Well, if you do that, what's going to happen is the water's going to come right back on you. And that's exactly what happens in worship. Do you think God benefits from your prayers? He doesn't need your prayers. You know who benefits? You do. Because he's teaching you the words of faith. He's, as a father would to a little toddler, say, I love you. Say, love you, Daddy. Teaching you the words of trust and faith. And the songs really are not so much a benefit to God. He doesn't need them. But who benefits? Well, I do, because I'm repeating what God has already done for me. And the people next to me benefit as well as we proclaim God's message. I can't throw love back up into heaven any more than I can throw water up. Comes right back down on me. He just pushes it right back down on me. But what I can do with water is I can redirect it. and I can redirect it to my neighbor, the people in my life. And when God's love comes down me and down my arm and through my fingers, it's going to come with all the dirt that is on me, and it's not even close to the amount that was poured out upon me, but it's still given out. And so our true worship, our true happens Monday through Saturday. But the funny thing about that is that that is actually what God wants, and that's how we please God. Think about Grandma on Thanksgiving Day. The family's gathered, and she backs out of the kitchen with this 16-pound turkey, and then she puts it down, and how wonderful it is, and we carve it up, and we eat it, and we have a great time. After the meal, we don't just sit there and constantly go up and bow to Grandma. Thank you. Thank you. And she doesn't care if you send a thank you note or not. It's not how it works. The greatest Thanksgiving that she can get back on that day, and she doesn't want you to do that anyway, the greatest Thanksgiving that she receives and what makes her happy is two things. One is that you're in there enjoying the meal. And the second is that can for just a couple hours the family get along. That's what makes her happy. And in a way, that's the same thing with God. He doesn't need your thank you notes. Now, we're going to say thank you because it's the polite thing to do. And because it's a relationship of love back and forth. And he's teaching us the words of faith. We're going to do that. It's good for us to do that. But he doesn't need that. You know what he wants? He wants his family to get along. Right? And so take what he gave you and give it out is kind of what's going on there. And so Luther in the monastery, what's a monk to do now that he's free from all of this? Well, he's now free to do what he was intended to do, which is to love a neighbor. So Luther had this great quote, and he said, these monks, they constantly bind themselves to rules where they don't need to be bound. Got to pray every 3 hours, or I got to do this, or I got to do that. Instead of seeing this freedom that God is giving, they've bound themselves where they're supposed to be free, and they've freed themselves where they're supposed to be bound, which is the love of neighbor. And so they were an ethical orientation of praying and pleasing God instead of a horizontal ethical orientation, the love of neighbor. Now let's go back to a second about this ultimate freedom and this ultimate slavery or servanthood to neighbor. Luther, in his commentary on 1 Corinthians 7:20, says, God doesn't even care about how you act. It is no difference to him if a man would send his wife away. If a man just leaves his wife, it is no difference to God. He doesn't care. And in great Luther fashion, he just leaves you hanging there for about a couple pages. Like, what are you talking about? And then he comes back later and says this. God doesn't care about any of that. He only wants faith and confession. Because that Jesus Christ righteousness, the gospel and forgiveness is just so radical that nothing can undo that. Not even if the guy's a sleazeball. But even though this guy owns nothing to God, he owes everything to his wife. His whole body, every moment, he is now a servant to his neighbor. And in this relationship, it is the neighbor of being a spouse. And so just as radical is the gospel is, so is the radical notion of love towards neighbor. And this is what we call the doctrine of vocation. The doctrine of vocation, in its very basic form, is that you are called by God to a relationship with a neighbor. And so we see the word voice there in vocation. It's a calling. You have a calling in a relationship to a neighbor. So just a side note, there's no such thing as a vocation of leader or something like that, unless you're the dear leader of North Korea, right? There's no kind of vocation of something vague like that. It always is in the here and the now, and it always has a physical neighbor attached to it. So there's no vocation of father without a child kind of thing. And that maybe seem obvious, but we don't always act that way. We kind of, when we choose careers, we tend to go, I want to be this. And we don't, and this seems to be detached from the world and from the neighbor. And God doesn't place us, he doesn't call us into positions that way. But rather, he creates us for a situation where we can love neighbor, where he can use us. So the best laid plans of mice and men, the best laid plans of a junior in high school is, I am going to be a doctor. And I'm going to go to this school, and I'm going to do pre-med, and then I'm going to go to that school, and whatever, and I'm good at science, and I love it, and I sure would like the money too, right? And they go through school, and something happens, and they don't end up going to med school, and this happens, and that happens, and they end up in something they never thought they were good at, never thought that they were tailored to do, never were going to ever, in their wildest dreams, end up. But that's exactly where God placed them and called them, in that relationship with neighbor. So you can think about yourself having many different vocations and callings, and they change throughout your life. Maybe take a step back and talk about how this changed for in Luther's time. In Luther's day, there was three estates. You had the clergy, you had the nobility, and you had the commoner. And those three estates were pretty static. There was no social mobility kind of thing. If you were a commoner, you were a commoner. If you were born in the nobility, that's where you would stay. Now, there's a growing middle class that Luther's family was a part of, but for the most part, that was what it was. In fact, social mobility, the really only way to go from a commoner to a different class, or the easiest way, I should say, was to become a priest or a nun. But then you had to give up the family. You had to give up a certain part of vocation in order to jump classes, so to speak. Well, Luther flips that upside down, or at least changes it, and said, now there's three estates. You have your churchly ecclesiastical estate, you have your civic estate, and then what he called like an economic type estate, which I would say that is both the family and what we might call business or career today, because a lot of those were melded together back then, right? You didn't go to work. Your work was at your home, whatever you were going to be, if you were going to be a farmer or if you were going to be a tradesman. And so notice that the Christian can have a vocation in each of those estates. Someone may be a member of a church and also a father or a mother, and also a farmer or a doctor, and also a citizen in whatever kingdom or whatever county they might be in. And so it's true for us today that we have these different callings, always in relation to neighbors. And I would like to talk about it in four. I'm only going to split up Luther's economic estate into two. So you all have a family vocation. In fact, you have many family vocations where God has called you in a relationship to a neighbor. And so some of you may be mother, grandmother, aunt, niece. You may be all of those things. And in each way, God has set you up with a neighbor. You may, in your churchly vocation, you may be a regular layperson, you may be a pastor, you may be on the council, you can think of those. Your civic vocation, you may just be a citizen of whatever city, state, and country you find yourself in, but you also may be on the city council or mayor. And then you have what we might loosely call a career vocation, and whatever that is in your life, that's probably going to change. I would throw in their student. Would be part of the career vocation. If you are retired, you're still a retired person with many vocations. I'd even go so far as to say that there is the vocation of being a patient in a hospital, because you are in a neighbor relationship with people in the bed next to you, but also the nurses and the doctors. And having been a pastor for 12 years and been in many hospitals, I have seen my members be very bad patients. to the doctors and the nurses. And you can ruin a nurse's day real quickly. You can also make a nurse's day with just a simple word of gratitude or whatever it may be. In that way, you are serving in a relationship with neighbor, and God has placed you in that specific time and in that specific place. And it's a calling. And now, why does God do this? I think there's a couple different reasons. You know, He could just feed us by sending manna and quail into our backyards in the morning and the evening. He's done it before. But He doesn't do that anymore. In fact, now He makes it a little bit more complicated and yet quite fulfilling for both the worker and for us, I believe. So instead of manna and quail in our backyard in the morning and the evening, He is going to use the farmer and the truck driver and the grocer and the FDA inspector and the checkout clerk and whoever's going to prepare the meal and whoever's going to wash the dishes. He's going to use all of those people so that I can eat and so that I don't die. God is using all of these people for me. I'm the neighbor in this relationship. And really, the relationship has three components. It has God, the vocation, and the neighbor. And God is using these people as if they were masks. And He puts them on and He hides behind them in order to love me, in order to love me. So I have a sense of value here that the FDA was set up for me. And these farmers are working for me. And the grocer is working for me. Even if those people may not even know it, maybe even sin against their vocation, God's using them for me. That's how much He loves me. And He wants to be very close to me. But He can't come with all of His glory, right? It would be too much for me. And I don't think He necessarily wants to be that kind of helicopter parent who's always right there anyway. And yet He wants to be very intimate and close with me. And so where do I find God? Well, He's all around me wearing these masks. I don't recognize Him, but I know He's there behind the farmer and the grocer and the fireman and the police officer and even the government officials, even if the love that falls down their arms is stained with their sin, it's still God using them for me. Think about how profound it is when a mother makes macaroni and cheese for her little son, and he's so delighted that he gets macaroni and cheese that he says, "Thank you, Mom." And then they sit down and they pray, thanking God. Well, what's the deal? Why are you thanking God and Mom? It's either or, right? No. It's both, because God has put on the mask of mother to love this little boy. And in the same way, and we know this from Matthew chapter 25 that Pastor Johnson alluded to. When we get to the last day and he says, "Well done, my sheep. Well done, my good and faithful servants. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was in prison, you came to visit to me. And when I was hungry, you fed me. And when I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink." And we say, "When did we ever meet you, Jesus? You were long gone. Whatever you did for the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me." And so when we serve other people without even a thought that we're doing this for the glory of God, the farthest thing from our mind perhaps, at that moment, we still serve Him. You don't serve God in a vertical ethical orientation trying to make Him happy. You serve God by being in a horizontal relationship with neighbor. And so, who fed that little boy macaroni and cheese? Jesus Christ did. Hiding behind the mask of mother.
And whom was fed that day? Jesus Christ was, hiding behind the mask of that boy. And so just how I said, I have value because the FDA was founded for me, I also, in my vocations, see value in everybody else that I meet that I otherwise would not have because I meet Jesus all the time. Because I meet Jesus all the time in that way. And so what this has done is that it has elevated the Christian to a startling height, a height that we could never find in ourselves, to the point where what I do is literally God's work. This is God's work I do when I am on my knees around the toilet, wiping down my child's barf in the middle of the night when they were sick. This is God's divine work. What a great privilege it is then for me to be a part of this divine equation. This changes your marriage, right? And I don't mean in a cute little way, well, there's three in the marriage, there's God, and there's the husband, and there's a wife. Yeah, but take that a little bit further. God has chosen me to be the avenue of his love to my wife. It's not really about me, but it's about God, because my God loves my wife so much that he wants her to be protected, to be cared for, to be encouraged, to be loved. And he's chosen me to do it. The closest thing we can get to understanding that is a person who has served in our military, and you go up to him or her and you say, thank you for your service. And they might say, you know, it was just a privilege to be a part of something bigger. It wasn't really about me. They understand how small they are, a little cog in this great machine called the United States Army or the Marine Corps or whatever, and that they were a part of a greater thing, which was the cause for freedom around the world. That's your everyday life, multiplied by the hundreds of different vocations that you have had during your life. That you are a part of something bigger, which is God's economy of love. That you are set up to a startling degree, lifted up to this very high degree to be a part of something great. And it does not matter one bit if the rest of the world understands that and gives you the right praise for that. Because you don't need that. Because you don't need that. And I'll say this, that it'll never be satisfying to you. There is not, I have to imagine that there is not one Hollywood star that ever stopped and said, I am fulfilled by all of this, this praise that I get by being a celebrity. In fact, it's the exact opposite. It's a drug that never satisfies, and so they need it more and more and more and more. There is nothing, and I think the reason for that is that we're created in the image of God. Therefore, we have, even though that image is lost, we still have this sense of drama and importance. We're made for something pretty great. And if we don't have something pretty dramatic in our life, we're gonna make it up. And we're gonna be unsatisfied. And I would suggest that since we're created in the image of God, there is no human adulation that's ever going to satisfy that need of importance. I don't care if you win the Nobel Prize every single year. I don't think you'll ever be satisfied. Innately, it's just never gonna happen. And so who cares if you get the right award at work or the raise or the title or the letters behind your name or anything like that? That's being curved in it inward anyway, and you're never going to be satisfied for that. Here's where you can attempt in a sinful world to get that satisfaction, knowing that scrubbing the floor in the bathroom is God's work, and that you're never gonna get the praise that work deserves, but it doesn't matter because you know how important it is, and God knows how important it is. You know, he knows what he's doing here, right? You know, we can't all be shortstops for the New York Yankees. There's only two senators from each state at a time, right? Quit telling our children that they can be whatever they want to be, right? Clearly, that's not the case. But think about if we were all trying out for shortstop of the New York Yankees or knocking on the door of being a senator in whatever state we live. Disease would run rampant because nobody cleaned the bathrooms. And God knows what he's doing. And he understands there's no senators and there's no New York Yankees unless the bathrooms are clean. And someone tills the field. And somebody puts out the fire. And somebody wipes the nose of the preschooler and the kindergartner at school and teaches them the ABCs, even though it's very difficult to do that. Right? And so he is elevating that, and he thinks it's important. Now, what this does for us is it means that I can take pride in my job in the right way. And you can take pride in just about every job. The accountant may put together a spreadsheet of the monthly financials for her business. And the CEO looks at it, crumples it up, and throws it away. And everybody else may go, whatever, and they just recycle it. But for her, it was a work of art. And the margins were all right, and all the numbers were there, and she got it on one page. And she took all of this complicated information, and she put it right there, and she took pride in it. And it was important that she did do that for the sake of the business, for the sake of the neighbors at those businesses help out and serve and love. And so you can take pride in anything you do. Think about when you clean your garage, perhaps some of you, or wash your car, something that seems to be menial, and you do it, you've done it enough that you know exactly how to do it. And you walk away and you go, all right. That's what God is giving you in the doctrine of vocation, by giving everything in importance. And so that becomes the great leveler where God sees the farmer and the emperor on the same level, because he understands how his economy of love works, and it's all important. And that means that you can also lose yourself into your job in the right way, where you take craft and you take pride in whatever it is that you do. Whatever it is that you do. And I would suggest that that's part of the freedom that we are given. And that I'm not trying to please God with this. Can't do it anyway. Don't have to do it. But he also gives me purpose. Let's take a step back and talk about freedom just for a little bit here. One of the constant complaints of Christians throughout history, even though they don't make it towards God, they're making it towards God, is this. If you give us too much grace, if you give these people too much grace, everything's going to fall apart. And so the Italians thought, oh my goodness, this Martin Luther character and his free grace without the threat of the law and without this whole monastic system, you give those drunken Germans that kind of leeway, who knows what's going to happen? As if the Italian monks were known for their piety. They weren't. We can't have too much Jesus. There's no way if you give them too much Jesus in church. If you have communion every Sunday, oh my goodness, they'll take it for granted. They won't do it. Everything will. Too much Jesus is never the wrong answer. And we always live kind of under that we just don't trust God enough. That somehow it's all just going to fall apart, right? But the truth of the matter is that when he gives us this kind of freedom, and it's gospel freedom, the exact opposite happens. Because now it's actually a loving thing that occurs instead of a curved inward kind of thing. So I don't do my good deeds so that I can make Daddy happy. By the way, this is kind of, I think, you can think about Luther this way. If you don't know, Luther's father wanted him to be a lawyer, and he was trying to make Daddy happy but there was a bigger daddy that he needed to make happy, and so he became a monk, and he was conflicted about that, right? And then when he had that freedom, right, then he was actually free to be successful in what he was going to do. And so notice that even though he was under this threat, and you feel bad for him because his dad's kind of domineering, and he had made the Father in heaven also domineering, really he was still curved inward. I'm doing this so that I get a benefit, so that my daddy on earth and in heaven loves me, right? Instead of being completely curved outward. And so once you have that freedom, it is not the end of the law. It is not the end of good works. It's just that it's done in freedom, and it's actually done quite better. And so once you have this kind of purpose in your life, that's one of the gifts of freedom. The purpose is not to please in a God who is an unpleasable God when it comes to the law. It's not so that I can get prestige and so I can get a better job, more awards or a better salary or whatever, because I'm never going to be satisfied with that. When I have that purpose, which is the love of neighbor, which seems like a law thing, it's actually one of the greatest gifts God has given us, because we're freed from that threat. Here's what too many Christians do. They say, yeah, I'm free because Jesus paid the price for my sins. I am free. I don't have to please God anymore. And so now I'm free to be about spiritual growth. Growth, 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 growth. We've placed ourselves too often under a new law. Do we grow and mature as Christians? Well, of course we do. But we don't. Well, we do it almost naturally without constant threat of, am I growing enough? Am I growing enough? Am I growing enough? I think it's really dangerous for us to have a spiritual growth chart like we did with our kids, when you put the pencil, you know, and then they grow up in there. Because you're going to see that you actually shrink quite a bit and then go up and down. It can be kind of frustrating. But it's also being curved inward. What is the telos? That is, what is the goal? Think of the word telos as telescope. What's the end? What's the destiny? What's the purpose? What's the goal? My personal growth? Well, here's a gold star for you. Instead of being curved outward to neighbor. And I would suggest that human beings, all of them, Christian or not, need that purpose. Because remember, we're not going to be fulfilled by awards. We're not going to be fulfilled by anything else. We need a purpose. When you're my age and your children annoy you, you find them sometimes as a burden. Those of you who are old enough understand what a great joy it was to be needed. What a great joy it was to be needed. We need to be needed because that means we have purpose. And if we don't have purpose, then life becomes quite miserable. One of my favorite professors said it this way: God chooses to need you. Just think about that right there. That's just part of the quote. God chooses to need you. God needs you. God chooses to need you so that you're not a waste of space. And he does it not because he doesn't want you to be a waste of space, but because if you were a waste of space, you would unravel as a human being without that purpose. And you'd have trouble getting out of bed in the morning. You'd probably fall into a deep depression, one that often ends in suicide. You need to be needed. You need to have a purpose. And in vocation, God says, I'm going to use you for this divine grand thing. I'm going to ask you to be grandmother, and you have no idea how important that is. And I'm calling you to do this, and this is literally divine work. Now you can get out of bed in the morning. Not only that, but he helps us, and this is not easy because we are sinners. But he helps us, and this is where spiritual growth does come in, where we kind of start to build character, and that often comes through suffering, as St. Paul says. And so in the doctrine of vocation, I'm gonna try to wrap this up in a couple minutes, even though it's going to be difficult. In the doctrine of vocation, that is the setting, vocation is the setting for this baptismal death and resurrection kind of thing. So when Pastor Johnson was talking about that baptism being a daily thing, I die to myself and I'm resurrected. Part of that being played out is I die, the result is that I die to myself and then I'm alive for other people. A mother's body is a death that then is a resurrection for her children in many ways, and not just in birth, but all the way through their lives. You know what I'm saying here? That when I die to myself, I'm living for other people. And in this suffering, you do grow spiritually, or at least that's the hope, to the point where stuff just becomes a part of your character. And so at one point, and you're always going to have bad days, but at one point, it's just an absolute burden in life. When you're a teenager, it's absolutely just unthinkable and a burden in your life to fold laundry. I can't believe how much I must suffer. But when you get a little bit older, it's just something you do. It's part of character. And you're not even thinking about the ramifications of this. Or how such a good little boy you were doing because you folded the laundry. But rather, it's who you are. Albert Schweitzer, the great African medical missionary, and I'm going to put words into his mouth, but he kind of got sick of what he would call liberal do-gooders. He would get people to help out during his African medical missionary journeys. And he had a lot of these European, probably English, do-gooders who felt the call, and notice the call was kind of for, it came from inside of them, was for them, felt the call to go help out these poor people in Africa. And they were doing it for their own virtue. It was virtue for the sake of virtue. It was a curved inward kind of thing. It was sanctification and good works for their own spiritual growth. Sanctification for the sake of sanctification. And he got sick of them, because they never lasted. He said he just wanted people that when they saw a sink full of dirty dishes, they just did them, because that's who they were. And not because they were thinking, oh, this is my good deed for the day. Right? And so it's just who you are. And I think this is a better concept of sanctification and good works that fits more in line with what St. Paul was saying in Romans, where it's a death and resurrection kind of thing. You die to your sin and you're resurrected a new person. This is who you are. You're the person that cleans dirty dishes. And then when you fail, you're back to repentance, back to baptism, and you die to that old person, and then you rise a new person, and it's kind of a daily thing, right? But it's not that I am always trying to, okay, I took a step forward in my spiritual growth, right? Put, you know, mark the line. But rather, it's a death and resurrection. This is who I am through this process. I'm the person that just cleans the dirty dishes because that's who I am. And what a surprise it will be then on the last day when God says, well done, good and faithful servant. When I needed the dishes done, you did them for me. And you'll say, I don't ever remember you asking me to do dishes. But it was just who I was. And the doctrine of vocation is where this is kind of played out, where God says, don't worry about pleasing me. You can't do it anyway. I got that covered. Jesus Christ is righteous for you. And I know that you need a purpose in life because I created you for something great. In fact, I fashioned good works in advance for you to carry out. And I'm going to give you some value, but it's not going to be in and of yourself. I'm going to free you from that law too and make you into something great. And I'm going to even use you in this great economy of my love. All right, we're at our time right now, and maybe we can just take like 2 minutes just to stretch your legs if you need to go to the bathroom. And then Wade and I will be up here for a short question and answer period. Thank you. Stop or... hit record again to stop it. Nope, I didn't hit anything. Is it stop or hit record again?